Hey, so look, are you a goods person or are you a services person? Because the economy really wants to know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. The fifth day of January today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The macroeconomic news of this Wednesday is brought to you by the letters P, M, and I, and by this somewhat existential question. What kind of economy are we living in? PMI stands for the Purchasing Managers Index, a look under the hood, if you will, at the service sector of this economy, which has long been our economic go-to. But goods, as we've been telling you, stuff has really taken over the past 2 years amid the pandemic ebbs and flows. And today's PMI, as Marketplace's Lily Jamali tells us, shows that services are still struggling.
This past December, as so many of us scoured store shelves looking for holiday gifts, Luke Kawa and his family decided to save themselves the headache and sit this Christmas out.
I wasn't as stuck in the supply chain snarls as everyone else might have been.
But as a strategist at UBS Asset Management, Kawa thinks the snarls could be straightening out.
This could be a bit of a darkest before the dawn type moment.
The December Purchasing Managers Index is back up that theory, but IHS Market Chief Business Economist Chris Williamson says on the plus side,
manufacturing, which has lagged, actually saw something of a pickup in December, because a lot of the supply chain issues that we've seen very widely reported have started to ease.
But the picture is a little less rosy in the service sector, where so-called backlogs of work persist. These are defined by IHS Market as received but unfilled orders that companies aren't able to either start or complete.
There's been an issue there in just not having the capacity to meet demand from customers.
Williamson says that's partly because it's still hard to find and keep workers. Despite those kinds of pressures, Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, says this all means we're on a path towards more moderate growth. And that's a good thing.
We know the economy can't sustain the sort of growth that we saw in 2021.
He wants to see it reach a level that has staying power. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
I think I said on Monday that this was going to be a jobs-heavy week in this economy. And hey, what do you know? It is. First-time claims for jobless benefits tomorrow. The Department of Labor's unemployment report on Friday. This morning, the private payroll processing company ADP said the economy added 807,000 new jobs last month, the most since May. And we ought to say this data predates Omicron. But also we ought to say that it's a national number, 800 and something thousand new jobs across the whole economy. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, all that hiring, well, it ain't happening everywhere.
There's a whole lot of hiring going on these days in all sorts of industries.
However, some states are experiencing much stronger recoveries than others.
Mike Maciag is a researcher at the Pew Charitable Trusts.
Generally speaking, states with economies more tied to tourism or other industries upended by the pandemic suffered more severe job losses and have had much slower recoveries. Hawaii and Nevada really stand out, as do coastal states.
Now, though, a lot of those states are seeing the most hiring. Between November 2020 and November 2021, Hawaii had the biggest drop in unemployment rate, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. David Cooper at the Economic Policy Institute says that's often how economic recoveries go.
It's this bounce back effect that the places that were hit the hardest are going to be the ones that we're going to be seeing the strongest growth in because, you know, they fell the most, so they have the most to gain.
Whereas other states, including many in the Midwest and South, aren't seeing as much hiring now because they didn't lose as many jobs in the first place. And they reopened sooner, says Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation.
The general trend had been that those states that were more cautious and aggressive in COVID mitigation efforts fared worse in terms of their labor market recovery.
But he says that started to change in the last few months.
Where I saw more of those discrepancies before between the South and the North and the West, I see more of a convergence, you know, maybe more of a national recovery at this stage.
The job market will continue to go up and down in different places along with the virus. But Stettner says a lot of the hardest hit areas are getting closer to normal. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, look, you might have seen all the red on your phone, and spoiler alert, I don't get to decide, but my money is on it being the Wawa's when we get there. But here's what happened. The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting this afternoon, the one where the bank started talking seriously about raising interest rates next year. Well, it turns out, unbeknownst to us until today, that they also started talking about winding down their balance sheet, not replenishing the $9 trillion worth of bonds the Fed currently holds when those bonds mature. Just talking, mind you, not actually doing. But traders are, as we know, a sensitive bunch. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It took us 7 days, just one calendar week, to almost double the COVID case count in this economy. 1 million new cases yesterday in a single day. And for those whose job it is to treat and care for us, positive or not, the demand for that care is way outstripping supply. Dr. Scott Anzalone is a family physician in Logan, Ohio, also one of the people we've been following for almost 2 years in our series called The United States of Work. Logan, we should tell you, is a small town, population about 6,900 people. And Scott's practice there is called Stagecoach Family Medicine. Scott, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
So let me ask you this. When somebody walks into Stagecoach Family Medicine, what happens to him or her?
So our regular patients that are coming in for routine care, they come in through the front door and get checked in just as like, you know, as we normally do. We have in the back of our office, we have a back entrance, and we have if you want to call it a COVID or safe room, a clean room. Hmm. But overall, they, you know, we do get patients cared for. Where we're running into problems, is if someone is sick enough and they need hospitalized and they need admitted to the hospital, that's where we're running into issues.
Yeah.
Because we're in a rural community. And if they're sick enough and they can't stay at our local facility, it's a matter of trying to find them a COVID bed in Columbus or, you know, near a neighboring hospital. I had one patient recently who was about 55 years old who it took quite a while to find him a bed. He was sick and, he did end up passing away. But, I think four of the hospitals they contacted refused his, transfer. We finally did find a hospital that took him.
How much of your time do you figure you and your staff are spending trying to find a spot for these people who need, you know, the next level of care?
Yeah, well, that part, and unfortunately, depends on how you look at it, it kind of falls into our ER physicians. So on our end, we're dealing more with the outpatient needs.
Right.
Those that are outpatient and qualify for the monoclonal antibody infusions, we do have that available. Well, I should say we have it available if it's available at the hospital.
Yeah.
They only get so many doses a week. But what we're running into with that is, you know, if I've got someone and I call over to our supervising nurse who's in charge of that, it's not uncommon for them to tell me that we don't have enough staff today to see that patient to do the infusion. They'll get to it when they can, and maybe the next day, you know, between finding, you know, getting them tested if we need them tested, you know, getting them at least an appointment at the hospital as an outpatient to get, you know, get the infusion if needed. It is an orchestration.
Yeah. Let's talk actually about the tests and the antibodies and all the stuff mm-hmm. you need to treat the people in your care, right? It's a, mm-hmm. I hate to bring this up, but it's like, it's a supply chain thing.
Well, and part of it is, yeah, I mean, outside of COVID, I guess it's all interrelated, but it's a supply chain issue, is I'm getting calls from our pharmacy, not too infrequently that, you know, medications that our patients are on are backordered. And some of my patients, you know, specifically a lot of these have been high blood pressure medications or high antihypertensives. Nothing else works but with what, you know, the combination that they're currently on. And I'm sitting there scratching my head when they tell me it's not available. I'm like, now what do I do?
So let me ask you a bigger picture question. You have a side hustle. You're a clinical professor and you teach medicine. And I wonder what you think the last 2 years will mean for the future of the medical profession, right? Because we've heard about the burnout. We're now hearing from you about small town, you know, last family practitioners. I mean, what are students that you talk to saying?
Well, the sad thing is, it's unfortunate. You know, we really need more primary care. Mm-hmm. The current market right now is really pushing our students into more subspecialties again.
So let me ask you this, just to bring it back to you now. We've talked before, you and I, about how you're looking for somebody to take your practice, you're thinking about retiring, and how's it looking now?
Yeah, well, I'm not planning on retiring anytime soon. Right, okay. I can't all financially, right. Okay, but maybe, you know, I'm looking at my 10-year plan here.
All right.
But I am looking for a partner,
yeah.
And you just can't find them. You know, like I said, I've got a practice that's busting. You know, the average family physician, usually it's about the ratio is about 1 to 2,500
mm-hmm.
Patients to physician, and I'm about 1 to 1 in 4,000.
That's not sustainable.
I'm tired.
Yeah,
this is, it is very, it's tiring, and I have really felt it in the last several months.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's not an option. We got to keep moving.
Dr. Scott Anzalone runs Stagecoach Family Medicine out in Logan, Ohio. Scott, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it. Best of luck.
Hey, thank you very much.
Talk to you soon. The Consumer Electronics Show is happening in Las Vegas this week.
Kinda.
I mean, it is happening, but with a lot less vigor than usual. Bunch of big names, Amazon and Google, Facebook, Twitter, General Motors, too, have said they're staying home. Thank you, Omicron. But among the new, ever more frightening humanoid robots and all the electric vehicles being unveiled, there's also a big old tractor from John Deere. A tractor at an electronics show. Yes. Because where farming's going, those tractors won't need drivers. Marketplace's Savannah Marr is on the Future of Farming beat today.
Tractors that steer themselves have been on the market for a while. One thing that sets this new machine apart is that it comes from John Deere, a traditional farm equipment company. Julian Sanchez is John Deere's director of emerging technology. He says this tractor can till a field with no one in the driver's seat.
Essentially, you sort of put it out in the field, put it in autonomous mode, and only worry about it when the job is done.
Sanchez says Deere's tractor will save farmers time and help address a major threat to the industry.
It's basically a relief of labor pressure.
Even before the pandemic, agricultural workers were hard to come by. Denise Reeser, a farm management instructor at South Central College in Minnesota, says populations are declining in rural places.
We do see younger generations wanting to move where maybe getting a better wage, more opportunities, other perks of living in a metropolitan area.
She says AI could eventually help fill that gap. One challenge will be convincing farmers to adopt it, says Michigan State researcher Bruno Basso.
The complexity in agriculture is the conservative mentality of the sector.
He says farmers will need to be convinced that autonomous tractors are worth it.
When a technology becomes available, they want to be sure that cost brings a return on the investment.
Even without the latest tech, John Deere's tractors can run $500,000. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
being able to close the door and just focusing on my work.
Ah, for a little peace and quiet, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. There you go. I called it. Okay, I have an inside track, but anyway. The wah-wahs today as the Dow Industrial's down 392 points, about 1%, 36,407. The NASDAQ plummeted 522 points, 3.3%, 15,100. The S&P 500 down 92 points, about 1.9%, 4,700 on the nose. Savannah Marr was talking about the new autonomous tractor from John Deere. Today, Deere & Company grew 0.2%. While we're on farming, the U.S. Department of Agriculture releases a monthly state-by-state crop progress report. Looks at what shape the soil is in, rainfall, a bunch of other farming-related soil conditions. In the report that came out this week for December, a lot of states report higher than normal temperatures. For instance, Georgia's temperature, 7 to 10 degrees warmer than normal. Moving to bonds, prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Thank you.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lost, I am sure, in the holidays and the virus news and all the other things that have been competing for our eyeballs and our ears of late, has been the one-year marker of the United Kingdom officially, once and for all, this time we really mean it, leaving the European Union. The negotiations took 5.5 years, and it's going to take at least that long, probably, to figure out what Brexit means for the various economies involved. The Brits, of course, and the Europeans. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been working the problem for us since the vote to leave back in 2016, and he has been making the rounds of some of the small businesses he has visited over the years.
The boss of this small rivet-making company, Clevedon Fasteners, was a passionate supporter of Brexit. Steve Hardiman says EU membership cramped the British economy by controlling its trade relations with the rest of the world. With one bound, Britain could be free.
I felt that Brexit would unleash the manufacturing potential of the UK, which is absolutely vast.
But 12 months on, Hardiman is a bit disillusioned. He doubts the current British government can make Brexit work for his company.
The British government machine hasn't got a clue when it comes to manufacturing and to industry.
The government, he says, failed to offer any guidance to companies like his on the new trading relationship with the EU. And he believes it bungled the Brexit negotiations, for example, leaving the EU with too much power over the British province of Northern Ireland.
And it doesn't fill me with confidence that they are going to make as good a job of Brexit as could have been made.
His company is actually thriving now. He admits that Brexit hasn't, in fact, had much of an impact one way or the other. The pandemic, however, has been a major headwind. The opposite is true of another small company we've been following, British Boxers.
We produce high-end, high-quality nightwear and underwear made in the UK, some of it, and some of it in across Europe.
Darren Price, co-owner of the company, says the pandemic lockdowns across Europe pushed his sales up by 50%. People wanted to pamper themselves while at home. But Brexit has meant that shipping in and out of the EU now involves a lot more paperwork and extra cost.
Which makes our margin smaller and our business less profitable.
He may now have to put up his prices. Always opposed to Brexit, Darren Price is now more convinced than ever that leaving the EU was a big mistake.
Yeah, far from having a positive impact on trade, as it was much mooted at the time, it's making it far more difficult for us to export.
Like Darren Price, the boss of this company in London, Lars Andersen, was also opposed to Brexit. He exports to families across the EU around 40% of his products, personalised name tags for children's clothing.
Hundreds of thousands of individual labels being sent out every day from this office.
To avoid the bureaucratic hassle of exporting to individual customers in the EU, he set up a subsidiary within the bloc in Ireland. Not trouble-free, though.
Adds complexity, adds cost, adds a little bit of time.
His life was so much easier, he says, when the UK was part of one huge single European market.
In my personal opinion, we should go back and gently ask if we could come back in. I realise that's probably not going to happen anytime soon, but one can always hope.
A sentiment that the Brexit-supporting boss of our next company doesn't echo. Jules Morgan makes pumps and other marine equipment, high-value products, and so he says the extra paperwork per shipment to the EU doesn't affect his bottom line.
No regrets at all, then, about voting for Brexit?
No, none at all. I'm absolutely delighted.
Morgan says that for him, Brexit wasn't only about trade. It was also about taking back control from Brussels. It was about restoring democracy.
I'm actually very proud of what we did. We have the freedom and the agility to be able to make our own decisions. I'm very optimistic.
It may not be until the pandemic is over that we'll know for sure whether that optimism is economically justified. Now the only safe assessment about Brexit is this. It hasn't been a triumph or a disaster. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Sam Fields was telling us earlier about the uneven jobs recovery this economy has been having as it works its way through the pandemic. And it turns out where we work on those jobs has been kind of uneven, too. But as we look toward the third year of this thing, that's going to be in March, right? And as uncertain as things are, we, that is all of us, companies and the people who work for them, seem to be quietly settling into some kind of normal around hybrid work. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
So I was walking through this Midtown Manhattan plaza, and I happened to bump into Ben Hedley Smith and Bex Flat sitting in winter coats at a cold steel table.
I'm not working right now. I'm interviewing currently.
Oh, you're doing a job interview?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, I'm so sorry.
They're literally doing a job interview in the cold because, well, COVID. But also Hedley Smith's company, which is launching in the U.S., is fully remote.
In London, we have a hub where we have 40 people in London, and people tend to come in once every week to be with each other. So we'll copy the same thing in New York.
Which is good, because Flat is not going back into the office more than once a week max.
I am an introvert. I love, you know, hanging out with my cat, being able to close the door and just focusing on my work.
And she says some companies she's interviewed with say they're remote, but then pull the old bait and switch.
You know, having a job post that says remote, but then you get into the conversation and it turns out it's not. That's been really, really common.
So you're like...
Yeah, at that point I'm like, and goodbye.
This tug of war between employers and employees is kind of the norm right now. And so far, the employees are winning.
A hybrid worker having the sort of flexibility that's associated with it has just become a basic expectation for every employee.
Brian Kropp is chief of research for Gartner's HR practice. Here's how the work-from-home landscape seems to be settling in for most companies.
About 5% of them have decided they're going to become a fully remote company where everybody works remote.
Another 5%, he says, have decided everybody's coming back to the office all the way, all the time.
And the remaining 90% are going to have at least some of their employees working remote at least some of the time in some sort of hybrid model.
Omicron has pushed out the start date of return to office for some companies, but most employers who plan to reopen the office have done so by now. This has basically been like steroids for a whole industry of consultants and apps designed to help companies manage shared office space and workflow.
Yeah, it has most certainly accelerated, yeah.
So, for example, Paul Statham is CEO of Condeco, an app that lets employees book and reserve office space, shared desks, meeting rooms. He says another feature he's seeing more and more in the workplace is downsizing.
You know, we used to work on ratios of one desk for every 1.2 people. We're now working with customers who are doing ratios of one desk for every 4 employees, one desk for every 10 employees, people that are even going for one desk for every 20 employees. So the real estate footprint is really shrinking against the number of employees.
Long-term commercial real estate leases make that a little complicated, so office downsizing is slow. Some companies stuck with, say, 8 floors are just consolidating down to 4 to save money on cleaning and utilities. Co-working memberships at WeWork are up 18% from March to November. But when companies bring workers back to the office, whether it's one day or all days, they still have to answer a question. Why? To do what work?
The challenge going forward is I don't think we actually know how the work is going to be done when people are on site.
Callie Williams-Yost is founder of Flex Strategy Group.
I think the type of work that's going to happen in on-site locations is going to be much more collaborative. I think the pace and cycle at which the work will happen on site may not be consistent.
Basically, there has to be a reason to get people in the office and get them there together and not waste everybody's time. That is the next big frontier of pandemic workspaces 2022. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I'm reasonably sure is also this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. I saw this in Politico, that a company called Dapper Labs out of Vancouver has registered to lobby Congress on NFTs, non-fungible tokens. We've talked about those. Those one-of-a-kind digital tchotchkes, I guess, pictures, artwork, videos. One does wonder how much Congress really understands about them, you know? All right, we got to go. A little bit tight on time today because I guess I talk too much. So you're going to have to find your own moment of economic context. Apologies. Our media production team is Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Tirado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.